What does it mean for God's will to be done on earth as it is in heaven? These are the words of Jesus telling his disciples how to pray. But what does that look like for us today? What does it mean to translate that prayer into action and to be a faithful Christian in postmodern secular society? Hi, you're tuned into the Commonwealth Matters. I'm your host, Richard Nelson. Joining us to talk further is Robert Cunningham, who founded a nonprofit organization called Christ for Kentucky, a group that does something called public theology. Robert is the former senior pastor of Tate's Creek Presbyterian Church in Lexington, Kentucky. He's a regular opinion contributor to state and national news outlets, and he also hosts a podcast called Every Square Inch. Robert, welcome to the program.
Hey, Richard. Good to be with you, man.
Hey, man, I appreciate you joining me in the Commonwealth Matters, and appreciate what you're doing with Christ for Kentucky. And in a lot of ways, our work intersects. Not only are we just down the road from each other in the Bluegrass State, but we are both concerned about Christians living out their lives according to the faith in culture, in the context of the cultural situation that we're in today. And you do it well. You have been a good representative of the Christian faith. One thing in particular I appreciate is you have avoided some of the pitfalls that are out there for Christians engaging the culture, one of which, and we'll talk about in a few minutes, is to be tempered as you approach politics and the political arena. And that's something that the older I get and the more I'm involved with the public policy realm, the more I appreciate that, because the temptation is to identify in a greater way with a political cause or a political party or a political ideology more than we would with biblical principles and a truly Christian worldview. So we'll get into that in just a minute. I don't want to get too far ahead, but Robert, tell us why you started Christ for Kentucky. Then I want to hear your definition of public theology.
Yeah. So crazy story of how I ended up forming my own organization. I'll be as brief as possible. I pastored a local congregation here in Lexington, Tate's Creek Presbyterian, for 17 years in total, 11 as in the senior leadership role. And my church is very gracious to kind of accommodate some of my unconventional passions as a minister. And so my job description continued to change. And every time my job description changed, it kind of removed me further from kind of the local church pastoral ministry work and out into the broader public work within the state of Kentucky. And I came to the point, there was another opportunity I was considering, which would have taken me out of Kentucky, which I did not want to do. I'm born and raised in Kentucky, love Kentucky, and Kentucky's my passion. And I was considering another opportunity that would have taken me out of Kentucky. And the Lord used that opportunity to kind of lead me down a path where I laid my life before him and said, I'm entering into my 40s, and what would the next chapter of ministry look like for me? And it ended up being saying no to that other opportunity, but also stepping down from leadership at Tate's Creek and forming an organization that allows me to do full time what really was burning inside of me already, which is kind of this broader Christian public leadership within our state. And so I just kind of by faith stepped out and formed a new organization. And that's what I do full time. I wake up and dream about the state I love and dream about how God's kingdom can come and will be done in Kentucky as it is in heaven.
Yeah. Yeah. So what is, and I appreciate that you're doing it. What is public theology? That's what you're doing. And that's how you define it on your Christ for Kentucky website. You do public theology. What is that?
It is public theology, but what I'm able to do that I think is unique is our mission is public theology and strategy for the common good of the Commonwealth. And so I'm able to combine, hopefully, robust, biblical, faithful, public thought work combined with public strategic work. Part of my critique of some of the thought leadership that we see out there is that it's only ideas out there in kind of the ether of the algorithms that never really manifest themselves in real practical ways. So now I'm able to not only do the thought leadership, but combine that with strategic leadership within Kentucky to actually see some things done. But public theology is a theological discipline that used to be a big part of the church's mission in the world, but we don't see it as much anymore. And so systematic theology would be taking the scriptures and systematize them into a thoughtful, coherent theology. Biblical theology is studying the scriptures and creating theology from the study of scriptures. Public theology is taking all of that systematic and biblical theology work and applying it into the public square. It's the application of Christian theology into the culture. And it used to be a big part of the pastor's job description. There was a time in our country where the voices that the public would turn to for cultural issues wasn't news pundits. It was the clergy, the clerical voice in our society. They served this pivotal role of a Christian voice into the public square. And so I'm kind of trying to resurrect that model and for Kentucky. Now, I'm not trying to be a national public thought leader, certainly not a global public thought leader. I just want to say, okay, this is the little nook of creation that God has entrusted to me. And I want to offer Christian thought into the world where he has me. And so that's a big part of what I do is that public thought work.
So when it comes to Christianity in the public square, I want to go back to what I started out with in this program, and that's that has largely been distilled to mean for Christians, conservative, evangelical Christians, largely means for them to have the right political views and to vote for the right candidates and get behind the right political party. You're speaking of something that's broader than that, aren't you?
I am. I don't want to be accused of neglecting the role of the state and the God-ordained kind of institutional arrangement that he has. I think the state plays a vital role, and it's an important role. But that being said, one of my big critiques of the Christian cultural project now is that there's a disproportionate emphasis and reliance upon the coercive power of the state to essentially legislate the culture we long to see. I do think that there are times when there is an intersection in my work in Kentucky. There are much of what we are doing does not require Frankfurt's approval or help. We are just mobilizing Christians to get some stuff done. But there are some areas where I feel like, okay, you know, this is an intersection where this is where I believe God has ordained the state to help. And so there is some areas where I'm in Frankfurt and meeting with legislators and advocating for policies that I think fit the common good of our state. But it's not exclusive to the state. It's James Hunter critiques this in his book To Change the World. It's the politicization of American Christianity, where our only visions of cultural change have been relegated to the coercive power of the state. And I just think that's a failed model. So it's a both and approach. Yes, there is legislative overlap, but by and large, I just think there's a lot that Christians can be doing that where we can be the change we long to see without kind of saying, you know, through lobbying efforts or through electing the right politicians and getting the right votes or whatever. That is an exclusive methodology to what we're trying to accomplish is what I'm trying to avoid.
You mentioned James Hunter in his book, To Change the World. Great book, by the way. Strongly recommend it. It helps. I just finished reading it for the second time just recently. And one of the things that he advocates for is that Christians have something called faithful presence in institutions. He believes that cultural change will happen when Christians are faithfully executing their role in various institutions, whether it's in higher ed or in arts and entertainment or in the media realm, whatever it might be. He argues that Christians need to be faithfully present in those areas. And secondly, he argues that Christians need to be very, very careful in their approach. Robert, is it fair to say that Christians today are more known for their public engagement as being combative, maybe angry, engaging controversial things or engaging in a controversial way? Maybe I'll put it that way. Is that a fair statement that's how Christians are seen in the public arena today?
Yes and no. To defend my Christian brothers and sisters who are trying to live faithful lives for Jesus. I do think what gets a lot of clicks and what gets a lot of attention would be those more combative Christians who are kind of taking this approach of retaliation against the culture versus a more redemptive approach to culture. I definitely think that we certainly are seeing a trend more toward that, viewing culture as an enemy to be defeated rather than a neighbor to love. I do see that. But I also wonder sometimes if I see that because that's what's getting highlighted and getting a lot of clicks and attention. Because in my normal life, offline, I do find a lot of Christians, faithful Christians, with this ethos of love, wanting to see change, but not wanting to be antagonistic in their approach to that change. But my experience is they just don't know, they don't have tracks to run on to see that. So part of what we're trying to do is to provide strategy and tools to mobilize that approach that I think is present among a lot of Christians.
I really appreciate your answer to that question or assessment, just because I've been involved with the public arena in Christian advocating for biblical principles and a Christian perspective on these issues for some 30 years. And maybe I shouldn't do a confession on a broadcast like this, but I'm gonna make a confession that I get super frustrated when I see Christians engaging in the wrong way, hateful, angry, vindictive, and I'm super sensitive to that. But I think you make a fair point that I think I'm sensitive to that because when I see it, I have a visceral reaction. I'm like, man, that is not the way of Christ. This is not a good representation of Christianity. But I think that there are many, many more people, like you said, who are faithful believers, who are perhaps reluctant to say anything, or they're on the sidelines and they're just withholding saying much because they don't want to get caught in the fray. And it is there is a firestorm going out there in the public arena. There is a worldview differential, if you will, from the secular left and then the conservative Christianity. And quite frankly, most of us would rather avoid the crossfire and the name calling and the labeling. It's just ugly and it's emotionally taxing, and it's a place where most of us don't want to be. But this is something that Commonwealth Policy Center and myself, we have tried to engage the culture from the position of a friend to love instead of an enemy to simply defeat. And it doesn't mean that we don't hold biblical values. It doesn't mean that we don't hold a sanctity of life ethic or a sanctity of marriage ethic as God has ordained it. It just means that we approach it differently. It means that we approach it with this ethic of love. We approach it with this idea of persuasion. We need to do a better job persuading. Casting a vision of beauty, right? Let's cast a vision for what is beautiful and what is good and what is true. And I constantly challenge myself and check myself. Okay, Nelson, do you have the right attitude as you're engaging? Are you approaching the right way, right? And I think for each of us, we all should do that gut check, shouldn't we?
Yeah. I think it's not necessarily the principles and the convictions that's a crisis within conservative evangelicalism. I think maybe we have an ethos crisis. It's not necessarily what we say, but how we say it. It's not necessarily what we're doing, but how we go about what we're doing. That is the real issue here. And so what I'm trying to do with Christ for Kentucky is resurrect a humble, gentle, persuasive, beautiful. I love that you use the word beauty, beautiful, compelling vision for the common good with a strength of conviction of we can do that. We don't have to compromise on anything so long as we don't compromise on the highest Christian ethic, the greatest of these, which is love.
We are going to take a quick break, but we'll be right back. Hi, my name is Richard Nelson, founder and executive director of the Commonwealth Policy Center. We're here to shore up the sanctity of human life, religious freedom, natural marriage, and sound fiscal policies. At the Commonwealth Matters, we have conversations with leading thinkers and policymakers to help us think biblically about the great issues of the day. If you appreciate our work, then please consider a donation today. This work is entirely supported by people just like you. Your gifts and tax-deductible contributions help to underwrite this program, and you help to get this important message out all across the Commonwealth. We believe that the Commonwealth of Kentucky is a great place to live, and we want to keep it that way for our families and our children. That's why we're standing for what's right, for what's good, and what's true right here in Kentucky. Thanks in advance for your support, and may God bless you. If you're just joining us, you're tuned into the Commonwealth Matters. I'm Richard Nelson here with Robert Cunningham. And Robert, I want to talk about appropriate engagement. Again, often Christians look at the political realm to engage, and that is an important realm. It's a realm that I've been involved with for close to 30 years. But there's other realms that believers can enter and seek to glorify God in those realms. But what would you say, and I guess you just said it before I took a quick break there, having an ethos of love, what does that look like? Because there's so much anger. And actually, there's a lot of fear out there too, right? Are we fearful? What is the ethos right now in the Christian society?
I think you nailed it, maybe unintentionally, that the way you connected anger and fear. And so there is no fear in love. Instead, perfect love casts out fear. And so I think what drives this combative, angry ethos is rooted in fear. When you fear something, it inevitably turns whatever you fear into an enemy that must be defeated. And so when Jesus looked out at the crowds, the culture of his day, he had compassion on them because they were harassed and helpless like sheep without a shepherd. It evoked his compassion. I think when we look at the culture, it evokes our fear. Everybody's freaking out about the culture at large. And what fear does, when you allow fear to dictate the terms of cultural engagement, it will inevitably lead you down a path that is combative and angry and militant. And so I actually think what needs to be renounced is less about this harsh spirit that we're coming about it. I think the deeper issue that needs to be renounced is the pervasive fear. I would even go so far as to say paranoia that I see all over American evangelicalism. Everyone's freaking out, and that freak out turns the nature of our mission into something that isn't Christian. Christianity is not based on fear. The cross is finished, the tomb is empty, the throne is occupied, everything's okay. Who knows what this chapter of the arc of redemptive history is going to look like? It might be a tough one. I don't know, but I do know everything's going to be okay. And once we recognize, hey, Jesus is risen from the dead, we're going to be okay. It kind of defangs the debate, so to speak, and we're able to enter into cultural engagement with a far more humble, loving, tender, yet firm, and courageous posture.
I love it. I love it. I love it. Now, with that said, and I couldn't agree more with everything you just said, if Jesus did in fact leave the grave, if he bore the penalty of our sins on the cross, if he rose again from the grave, that is the greatest thing that happened in all of human history. And it is the most freeing thing, both for our souls and also for our outlook towards the future. And that's what you're saying. Now, I'm going to press in on this a bit, though. I agree with 100%, and I'm with you in your optimism. In fact, I think we share the same eschatological view. But what about pressing issues like public safety, man? You don't have to be a Christian to be a bit afraid if your community's breaking down, if it's not safe to go out after dark, or if you have gangs in certain parts. And we don't see it here in the Bluegrass necessarily, maybe in Louisville in some parts. But public safety, I look at that. That's a good practical issue. You don't have to be a Republican or a Democrat to care about public safety, but we all do. And if there's breakdown in your community to where it's no longer safe for your kids to play outside, or for you to walk out down the street after dark, I mean, isn't it natural for us to fear, Robert? Aren't we going to be a little bit afraid of just public, our own safety out in public?
Yeah, I mean, there's absolutely natural fears. And those fears can be, you know, God ordained natural instincts that are there for a reason that we need to, you know, it's just we need to listen to that and stuff. But also fear can be disproportionate and taken to a level that is harmful to us. And I think I agree with you, like you brought up public safety. Do I think public safety is an issue? Yeah, absolutely. I think probably we're talking more nationally than my beloved bluegrass state. But yeah, I mean, yeah, I'm sure that there are public safety issues going on in Kentucky. I do think, again, I keep coming back to what gets highlighted. I mean, I think what technology, my current research commitment is in the area of technology and what it's doing to us. And I think technology, I think the algorithms highlighting these anecdotes of fear drives us far more than we realize. It creates this boogeyman that's out there. And so I think it can be disproportionate. I think public safety has always been an issue since Genesis 3. And so but I would say this, let's not be lulled asleep by a blessed chapter in history of relative Mayberry-esque Christian subculture comfort to think this is the norm of Christian history, when it is absolutely the exception, not the norm. You know, Jesus, you want to talk about an antagonistic culture, just look at Jesus and the oppression of the Roman Empire and the early church and Nero and all that. I mean, we don't know public safety concerns like they knew. And still, they were able to move forward, I'm sure, with an appropriate amount of protection and an appropriate amount of concern and fear. I'm sure that was those emotions were going on. And yet the church moved forward with saying, we are still committed to say we will match your threats with Christian love. And we will disarm you with a weapon of love. So if Jesus and the early church could move into a very dangerous culture, so to speak, with that spirit, I think we could still do it, even in the face of, you know, public safety threats and so forth.
Yeah, I appreciate you unpacking that. I felt like I had to give an example of why people might be fearing. But I think what you're talking about is an ethos or a controlling emotion, right? And as Christians, we should have this ethos of love and of confidence in what Christ has done for us, right?
Yes, absolutely. Not just controlling emotion, but controlling conviction. I mean, do we believe that Jesus Nazareth is risen from the dead? If so, N.T. Wright tells us we have an entirely new epistemology. We have a new starting point of the way we view everything around us. And if Christ is triumphant over death, and we are united to that Christ, and we are carrying on that resurrection project that he began on Easter Sunday. And I know circumstantially there you might see a lot to fear, but the point of the resurrection is we have a greater circumstance that transcends whatever circumstance we are facing. And that greater circumstance has a way of transforming these more immediate pressing circumstances that tend to freak us out.
I'm going to move on to a little bit different area here. You host a podcast called Every Square Inch. You cover a wide range of topics. You've done, I think, a 10-part series so far on technology and how we should think Christianly and biblically about it. Well done, by the way. I've listened to a couple of them. Strongly recommend that podcast. Now, the name for your podcast, Every Square Inch, the title comes from a statement made by Dutch theologian and statesman Abraham Kuyper, who once said this: there is not a square inch in the whole domain of our human existence over which Christ, who is sovereign over all, does not cry, mine. Couldn't agree more with that. However, when a statement like that is heard from a secularist today, especially in our current political context, you know what comes to mind is Christian nationalism. You're saying that you think that Christians should be in office and impose their will or legislate Christian morality. Are you a Christian nationalist, Robert?
I am not a Christian nationalist, and I hope that our state, which is the political realm, is not neutral ground. It is a profoundly philosophical and I would argue religious exercise, though ideologies that tend to dominate politics often are not called religious, but if you actually look into the ideologies, they are enacting those ideologies in a very religious way with strict orthodoxies and heresies and church disciplines and what up. So
I didn't want to interrupt, but there are different definitions of that. And of course, that was tongue in cheek. I was accused of being a Christian nationalist the other day. I testified in front of a legislative committee, and the definition that this person had was essentially, and I'll reduce it down to what she meant, was if you have a worldview based on Christian morality, then you're a Christian nationalist. And if that's the part of the definition, I think I'm guilty.
Well, that's why I was fleshing it out. Let's not be naive to say that the political realm is somehow the one sphere of society that is exempt from that is neutral and exempt from ideological influence. It is not. And so if you define Christian nationalism as recognizing that all governments at the end of the day are not neutral, but they are legislating an ideological, I would argue, a religious vision of morality. That's what they're doing. Do I want the ideological religious ideas that are impacting legislative decisions to be Christian ideas? Of course. Yeah, everybody wants. I mean, gender and sexual ideology is obviously big in our culture right now. Do I think those more progressives who want to see gender and sexual ideology reflected in legislation, do I call them LGBTQ plus nationalists? No. But do I blame them for wanting to see their vision of what is good, true, and beautiful implemented in the state? Of course not. That's what everybody's doing. I just would like it to represent what I believe is true, beautiful, and good. I don't think that's Christian nationalism. If you're defining Christian nationalism in its classic sense of a legislative church state, Christian imposed society, then no, I'm with the founders on this one. I think they were striking. You know this. My PhD is in that era of American history, and I think they were striking a beautiful balance, which is that the church and state are informal partners towards the singular telos of a flourishing common good society, and the state viewed themselves as our role is to protect. Public religion to have the freedom to do its thing. And then public religion's role is to cultivate the society they long to see. And then that way they kind of work together as informal partners. There's not a wall of separation like Jefferson said, but I'm not asking those to come together like the resurgence of Christian nationalism is asking to do. I'm asking us to hold to that original vision, which is the state is there to protect the role of the church to do her thing. And the church is there to get to work in creating and cultivating the world we long to see.
Very good. That's well said, Robert. But so what does the church do today in the context of its, in some ways, losing its credibility? We've had a number of scandals. The younger generations, millennials, are leaving the church in droves. The largest religious affinity group in the nation are the nuns. I think about a third, just under a third of all Americans identify as no religious affiliation. So the church is definitely losing its preeminence in society. I don't know if credibility is the right word, but we're losing our influence. And people are pointing out the contradictions and the hypocrisy and some of the scandals. So where does the church begin in this context?
To connect that question to the discussion we've been having, you're right. We are losing essentially millennials on down through Gen Z. And when you look at the research of why that is, number three on the list is a politicized Christianity. They're growing increasingly weary and exhausted of politics and the political divide in our society. And when they see that replicated within kind of these sacred boundaries of church life, when they see our churches divided along the predictable lines of our partisan divide, when they see our vision for, they're all about cultural change. Our youth are all, they're the justice generation. They want to see a different world. But they are far more into activism than politics. And so when they see our answer to here's how we change the world, when they see that politicized and they say, oh, the church is just like everybody else in our society, they're politically obsessed, that's a turnoff to them. So I actually think the way to kind of recapture our youth is they're actually longing for something that isn't different, that isn't following the predictable narratives of our culture and society. They are longing for a space that feels like almost like a different world. And this has been the nature of the church's cultural engagement. We're gonna form a rival kingdom, a rival vision of the good life. And we are going to enact that within our membership. We are going to testify to the world of this is how it ought to be. And we're gonna live that out. And those who are weary of what's taking place in our society, those who have been exiled, socially exiled from our society, come in and discover this better way of life formed by Matthew 5 through 7, the Sermon on the Mount, specifically those Beatitudes. Come discover a different way of doing life. And so I actually think recapturing the uniqueness of the Christian church and the Christian vision, I actually think would be compelling. That's why they're kind of, when you do look at the statistics more, what those nuns tend to gravitate towards, religiously speaking, is more ancient, historical, mysterious versions of the Christian faith. Those traditions actually are gaining appeal within our society. When they see us just essentially try to mimic the world, and not just in its like political debates and stuff like that, but I'm even talking down to the way to reach the culture is to try to mimic the culture, is actually a failing strategy. I think our youth are saying, hey, you know what it kind of feels like, Richard, is, you know, when parents try to be cool with their kids and try to, like, you know, use their vernacular and dress like them, and kids are like, this is so lame, you're so cringy, I just want you to be a parent. You're a parent, be a parent. That's what I feel like is the aversion to Christianity in America, is it feels like we're trying to be cool and hip and stay with the culture and all that, when I think they're saying, you know what, you're a church, we want you to be a church, because you offer something that is completely different than we have offered to us in the rest of society.
That's good. That's good. Robert, I'm going to share a statement here that I pulled off of your website, Christ for Kentucky. And this might sound radical to even believers out there, but this is what you say. Beneath the reign of King Jesus, Kentucky ought to be heaven on earth. Therefore, the Christian may claim Jesus is sovereign over every square inch of our commonwealth, but there is little evidence this is so. That seemingly irreconcilable dilemma is what the followers of King Jesus are expected to reconcile. Jesus owns all things, but because of the parasitic nature of the fall, it doesn't look like Jesus owns all things. What followers of Jesus are you going to do about it? So, provocative statement. It's something we don't hear from our churches. Really, Robert, Kentucky is supposed to be heaven on earth? I mean, tell us more. Let's just focus on that. Really, you believe that?
I don't just believe it ought to be heaven on earth. It will be heaven on earth when Jesus is done with earth.
Tell us more. Because this is, look, and let me interject here. The Christianity that I grew up in was heaven is somewhere far away. I remember singing songs in Sunday school where heaven is in outer space, man. There was no talk of the new city coming down to earth. There was no talk of a new heavens and a new earth. It was somewhere out there. And I would submit to you that many of the listeners and viewers of this program still think, and I'm talking Christians, still think heaven is somewhere out there, that the earth has nothing to do with it. So tell us more. Why do you believe this?
I'd be glad to. That's a whole other program. Let me give it as quick as possible. So, yeah, so the fallacy we believe is that essentially here's the nature of Christian missiology, Christian mission while we're here. We essentially form these fortified Christian subcultures that, in a sense, are hiding from the dangers and evils of the world. And our only extent of cultural engagement is via evangelism, which I am a firm believer in evangelism. But essentially, it's this. We're going to leave the fortified subculture to evangelize, try to convert as many people as we can, and invite them to join us within the safe confines of the Christian subculture until we all get to escape this and go to heaven one day. And that's essentially the Great Commission, according to, you know, evangelicalism over the past century, I would say. That's not how the Christians historically have viewed their mission and project on the earth. We pray thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. And we mean that prayer. We pray it and we labor to be the answer to that prayer. So at the end, when this is all done, it's not we are going to escape earth to get to heaven. Heaven's going to come to earth and transform in the same way Jesus resurrected from the dead. The entire creation is going to go through a resurrection of sorts. And literally our final destiny is heaven on earth. That's the eschatological hope of this. In the meantime, in this period between the resurrection and ascension of Jesus and the return of Jesus, what are we to do? Well, we are to give our lives away, not with this messianic triumphalism, cultural transformation, as if we are going to fix Kentucky in our lifetime, but we are trying to get Kentucky one step closer to its final destiny. And so there is a lot of work to be done beyond evangelism, and even evangelism itself. It's a compelling vision, particularly again for our youth. I'm not just telling you, here's how you can escape earth and get to heaven one day. I am offering you, evangelism then is not just saving souls. It is saving souls, and it's recruiting them into this glorious redemptive project as ambassadors of Christ's redemption here on earth. And so it's inviting them to see their vocation, their family, their marriage, their neighborhood, everything as an opportunity, not a meaningless, mundane life, but everything is an opportunity to bring the reign of Jesus to bear, to bear witness to the kingdom here on earth and bring the reign of basically every sphere sovereignty. You brought up Kuiper, every square inch belongs to Jesus. It's this notion of sphere sovereignty. Whatever sphere God has entrusted to you, you're planting a proverbial flag in the ground and you're saying, this belongs to King Jesus and it will function according to the ways of the King. And in this way, you are bringing about the redemption of Christ where he has you. It's a far more compelling vision for people's lives. So, you know, what I like to say, it doesn't matter what you're doing, but what you're doing matters. And not just in those evangelistic conversations, but everything is an opportunity to make the invisible kingdom of God visible on earth.
Very good. You say along these lines, you further say on your website, God is redeeming all of creation back to its pre-fallen state. Wonderful news, but the news remains inconsequential to our lives if not pressed down into the ordinary of our lives. And I think the question that many believers have is, man, what does this look like? I'm going to the office every day. It's a secular workplace. I don't even know where to begin. Or the stay-at-home mom taking care of her kids. And what does it look like to be a partner with God as he's redeeming all of creation back to its pre-fallen state?
Okay, let's put ourselves in her shoes. Well, let's not try to do that. We can't do that. But if she's listening, all right, she's got those knuckleheads in her home that require so much demands, and it's exhausting work. It's the hardest work anybody can do. Okay, is that a service to Jesus? Well, let's flesh this out. Just talking about, we're talking about cultural redemption. Let's talk about cultural redemption. In the grand scheme of cultural redemption, motherhood or fatherhood or the home, what does it play? Well, I've got four boys. Christ for Kentucky is important to me. But more important is my vision for, okay, those four sons are not just four individuals who I want their souls saved so they can be in heaven with me one day. No, no, no. They are seeds of kingdom potential. They represent I'm biased, but I think I've got great sons and they're very gifted and they're They're amazing. I'm obsessed with my kids. I want that potential leverage for the purposes of Jesus on earth. And so in pouring in discipleship, in those earlier years, just the basic discipleship of nurturing, care, and the more formative years, the discipleship of giving them a vision for how God could use their lives and wherever God calls them, that represents such massive, massive potential. And then they're going to have kids. And those kids are going to have kids. And what if one home creates a multiplied legacy of kingdom witness on earth, a legacy that is infiltrating every sphere of society? You know, whether God calls one of my kids into business or academics or the arts or the trades, do you know how significant it would be for a business owner in a world full of business corruption and greed and cutthroat practices to have a business that says, no, we're going to run this business the way Jesus would have me run this business, with integrity, with honesty, with service, with generosity, not greed. That's a game changer for a local community. Part of the problem with cultural redemption, I think, is people think nationally and even globally, and it's so paralyzing. But when you begin to do what I think Jesus calls us to do, which is incarnational ministry, meaning localism, localism, localism. Do I think my four sons can change the world? No. I know parents love to tell their kids that. No, I don't think my four sons can change the world. Do I think that my four sons, wherever God has them one day, in that small little local community and neighborhood, do I think they could be a redemptive presence locally? Absolutely. And then they're going to have kids, and those kids are going to have kids. And all of a sudden, we have created this massive multiplying legacy of cultural redemption. Your changing diapers leads to changing the world.
That's fantastic, Robert. Fantastic. So we're running out of time here, but I want to close with on this thought that you just fleshed out well. It is an idea that I've listened to in your podcast. I see it in your writings, but you have this idea that followers of Jesus are his ambassadors, right? We're ambassadors for Christ. It comes from the passage 2 Corinthians 5:20. We are Christ's ambassadors, God making his appeal as it were through us. So we have, wherever God puts us, that homemaker and that mom or that trade worker or wherever, we're ambassadors in society, those Christians who engage the political realm. And I guess we'll close on this. That's on my mind. We're in a very real political season, presidential election year. In Kentucky, the primary elections are just about 2 months away. So I think about, what does it mean for a Christian today in the Commonwealth of Kentucky entering into the political fray, into that realm as an ambassador of Christ? What does that look like?
Yeah. So the political sphere of society, for those that God has called into that, and of course we should, the beauty of our country and the way it was framed is, in some ways, every American citizen, eligible American citizen, is allowed to participate in that process, which is a beautiful, beautiful thing. But for those specifically within that realm, I come back to the ethos thing that we spoke of earlier. I would just say, man, not only do I think it honors the Lord to be a convictional politician, I'm not asking anybody to compromise their convictions, to be a convictional politician who enacts those convictions in a refreshingly different way that our world is like, whoa, okay. I'm not used to politicians acting that way. I'm not used to humility. I'm not used to charity. I'm used to straw manning opposition. I'm not used to steel manning their position and really thoughtfully engaging it. And let's have dialogue and stuff like that. I'm just not used to that. Not only do I think that is being faithful to Jesus and leading with that ethic of love, I just think we are really close. I think we're really close to a cultural tipping point where the partisan divide kind of implodes on itself, and there's this growing mass of folks that are underrepresented in the media and certainly on social media, because that you can't monetize thoughtfulness. You can't monetize level-headedness. You can't monetize agreement. You monetize anger, disagreement, fighting, all that stuff. But so they're underrepresented, but I think there is a growing swell of folks who are just longing for somebody in the political realm to say, I'm going to, of course, hold to my convictions. I believe them and I'm going to practice them. And I'm going to do that differently than what we're used to. I actually think it would be incredibly compelling to our society. I think people want to get behind it. I've experienced it myself. This will not come as a surprise to anybody. I'm a conservative convictionally. And I have noticed this intrigue from progressives about my work and thought that has led to friendships, conversations. And I just think it really comes down to is I literally direct quote from one of those friends. I disagree with everything you're saying, but you're saying it differently. I want to hear more. And so I just think getting back to that ethos of that Christian ethos accompanying Christian convictions, holding those two in the balance, I think is the way forward for those that God has placed in the political realm.
Very good. That's a good word to close on. Robert Cunningham, thank you for joining us on the Commonwealth Matters. It's been great to have you on. And for those of you tuned in, thank you for joining us as well. If you could do this, go to your favorite podcast platform and rate us. That's a great way to help others learn about us and understand us better. And then also tell your friends about us. That's a good way to get the word out about our work as well. Robert, thanks again for joining us. God bless you, and you keep up the good work.